When you want to grow your business, use Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Seamlessly collaborate with your team using a suite of built-in tools and features to make your workday easier, like huddles to schedule impromptu meetings and avoid another calendar invite, or Workflow Builder, which lets you automate routine tasks so you can spend more time on the work that matters most. Slack. Grow your business here. Learn more at slack.com.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. There's lots planned for today's show. We'll have a roundup of the latest round of the County Championship. We'll look at a couple of the biggest talking points in the IPL. We'll hear about a brand new competition championing the women's game that gets underway this week. And we'll also be assessing some of the front runners for an England test spot with the first test of the summer less than a month away. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, and CricVis analyst, Ben Jones. First, some news that we talked about last week that has since been confirmed. Ben Stokes is the new England Test captain, and speaking to the media yesterday, he outlined his desire to see both Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad return to the Test fold this summer. Here's Butch's take on Stokes' first week in office. There are a couple of standout lines, Butch, from Stokes' first day on media duties. He said about Broad and Anderson, "The best way to give yourself a winning Test match side is picking your 11 best players. If James Anderson and Stuart Broad are fit, they're up for selection because they are the two best bowlers in England. They are two greats of the game, and in my opinion, it's stupid to never consider them for selection. They are part of the best 11, so it's pretty simple." Ben Stokes only captained England in one Test match, and for that one Test match, he didn't deem Stuart Broad to be in England's best 11. So what do you make of his assessment that Anderson and Broad are England's two best bowlers?
First thing I suppose is when your head is on the chopping block, you tend to see things slightly differently than perhaps you might do when you're just in the ranks. So I wouldn't read too much into the previous occasion where he left out Stuart Broad. None of that is anything that anyone could disagree with, really, is it? I mean, he spent hundreds and hundreds of overs in the field in the West Indies just recently without those two bowlers. Whether or not either of them would have made a massive amount of difference is a moot point, particularly on the pitches in Barbados and Antigua. I think obvious that they would have been a cutting edge for England in Grenada, as Carl Myers was. it's what you'd expect him to say, to be perfectly honest with you. The other guys, the youngsters, like Matt Fisher didn't do himself any harm. No, did Saki Mahmood. They both had periods where they looked the goods. But the simple fact of the matter is that they are a long way away in terms of experience. And therefore, if you're looking to try and, as a captain, try to get off to a flying start, get wins under your belt, particularly playing in conditions at home, then you are going to pick those two guys. It absolutely stands to reason, and none of it should surprise anybody.
Yeah, I guess that when you actually come down to like working out what a bowling attack will look like in home conditions, you can quite quickly get into a position where it's not that easy to squeeze them both in. So Ollie Robinson had a brilliant year last summer. He was probably England's bowler of the summer. We don't know how fit he is at the moment, sure. There's always a question of who bats eight, because if you pick just the four best bowlers, that is a very long tail, especially if you want to get a spinner in there. I know Jack Leach didn't play last summer, but there might be a temptation to bring in either him or Parkinson for the first test of the summer. So as soon as you do that, and you might want a bowler who's got a point of difference like a Mahmood or Wood when he's fit, then it is not that straightforward to get both of them in the side.
No, you're right. But then if you're saying, so Ollie Robinson, for example. Now, Ollie Robinson is almost a carbon copy of one or the other of Broad and Anderson, isn't he? You know, it gives you exactly the same. And so, you know, you could, if you wanted a bowling attack with Stokes as your four seamer, Broad and Anderson both in it, Mark Wood as your pace bowler, presuming the pitches remain as good and as unseamer friendly as they have been in the first rounds of the championship, then that's your bowling attack. And I think for England, I think in order to make the decision about Broad and Anderson's future as clear as possible, which is why I disagree with neither of them going to the West Indies, was you play them until they prove that they're not. Stop worrying about what's happening in the, you know, in the winter, or where you're going in the winter, and who's going to be rotated in and out. Play what you think your best 11 is, and if they prove themselves not to be your best 11, then you say thank you very much for your unbelievable service, and you move on. Mm. But the reason we're in the position we're in at the moment is because, and I've said it before, and I will say it again, if either of those two guys had played in Antigua and Barbados, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation now. You know, that they would have been pensioned off, and it would have been time to have looked elsewhere. And that's, you know, that's no slight against either of them. It's just that we would have seen that in those conditions, they would have fared probably no better than the guys that played.
The other interesting thing was that Stokes said that he wants to bat at six, which again is quite interesting, especially with the number of holes there are in that top seven anyway. It does push at least one of the holes in that side for a potential newbie higher than it might otherwise could be.
Yeah, it does. But then, you know, he's captain now. Well, it was the same with Root, wasn't it? I mean, you know, Joe, for ages, everybody said he should bat at number three. I didn't say he should have bat at number three. I was very happy with him at number four, making runs. But Ben now has the added responsibility of being captain. And if he sees it that six is going to be the place where he is most productive with the bat, with the ball, and has a clear enough mind to manage all the rest of the stuff, then that's where he goes. You know, and interestingly, somebody like Josh Bohannon, perhaps, or even sort of, not even, but sort of somebody like Ollie Pope, again, five would be a more natural fit for either of those two than four in the Test match team. So look, I don't see that as being a major issue. Johnny Bairstow, obviously, you know, he's been batting at six. He's been very happy at six. But when you're in the side as a batsman only, then, you know, perhaps five might be a better spot for him as well. Mm. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff in terms of the balance of the England side. You know, Ben Stokes is interesting because by right, he should balance the team, being, you know, top order, a top six batter who bowled. But quite often England is sort of looking around trying to shelter him from doing too much bowling. So it's almost like he unbalances them. You've got an all-rounder there that you're not expecting to perform as an all-rounder. Mm. So all of these things will fly into the mix. And, you know, around that, if he's brave enough, not brave enough, but if he wants to pick Broad and Anderson in that first Test match of the summer, then you put the pressure on them, don't you? You say, listen, you guys, you prove it. Win us Test matches. And you are unimpeachable. If you don't, then nobody will have a problem with moving on. They really won't. Least of all the guys themselves. If they feel that they're not worth the place in the side, and they've been allowed to prove it on merit, i.e. by being on the park, rather than being left out for sort of spurious rest and rotation reasons, then they're big enough and old enough and ugly enough to turn around and go, look, okay, now's the time. But all the while that they are sort of keen to prove or aren't being given the chance to prove whether or not the best two in the side, then this argument rumbles on forever.
And just generally, what have you made of Stokes' first few days in the job? I guess, you know, you generally don't expect that much from a new captain when he speaks to the press for the first time. But Stokes has said, you know, in a quite forthright manner, exactly what he thinks about some key issues that have been question marks hovering around this side for a while.
Yeah, and that's great, isn't it? And it's kind of, you know, you've got Rob Key, who's is completely no bullshit. He's just, he has no time for bullshit or bullshitters. Good luck with the beeps. And I'm guessing that Ben Stokes is very much the same. And that's refreshing. You know, you've got two guys there that are in charge who are as far away from people who are going to use management speak and all that kind of nonsense as you can want. And you know, we're in the honeymoon period, aren't we? It's always easy until the teams take the field. And at the moment, he's making the right noises. He's doing exactly what you'd expect him to do, which is be forthright about his right to be in the job. He wants to put his stamp on it, and I'm sure he will. And look, you know, in terms of the wisdom of the whole thing, as we've said, he's kind of like he's the only choice. I think he will throw himself at it as he throws himself at everything else, you know. And any worries that people might have about, you know, either his workload or the way that it might affect him off the field and all these other things, I think you can park those worries with Ben until such a time as the whole thing comes to a head and it goes boom, you know. He's going to give it absolutely everything he's got. And I really hope it's successful for England. Even if it doesn't last very long, I mean, that's, you know, we tend to get suckered into the idea that being made England captain is a sort of job for life until it breaks you. Well, it doesn't have to be like that. Mm. I think 2 years of Ben Stokes operating at full tilt, at full madness, might be very, very exciting for everybody. And I, for one, am very happy to look forward to it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Edward asks, is Ben Jones okay after the news that Stokes will not only move up to number three, but actually move down the order? For listeners who are unaware, Ben has for a long time advocated Stokes batting at three in Test cricket. So, yeah, Stokes has said he's going to move down at number six. So, Ben, how are you doing?
Yeah, I've had better weeks. No, I've long since abandoned hope on that one, I think, you know, as his body started to crumble a little bit. I was thinking maybe we can turn him into a specialist bat and push him up the order, but he seems to be quite reluctant to. And Root did so well moving up to three in the Windies. You have to kind of, yeah, take that one on the chin. But it's frustrating because genuinely, like, I've been saying this for like 4 years of like Stokes's technique is just unreal. It's so solid. All of our models suggest that he's naturally a number three, and you know, his natural exuberance, you know, if you take that away, he is perfect. And you know, he went through that amazing 2020 and had that run of form, but then obviously since then his time out of the game, I think, rather took the sting out of the momentum of it. And yeah, as a result, he's back down to number six, where normal all-rounders go rather than the geniuses, which is what we wanted to try and make him into. But yeah, I'm happy to take this one. I have to come up with a new agenda. I don't know what it will be. I've normally got a few lined up, but the cupboard's bare at the moment.
Well, we'll talk more about England later in the show, but let's first look at the latest round of county championship action. Somerset, after a miserable start to the season, were the only team to win in Division 1. Matt Renshaw, who was named in the Australia A squad this week for their upcoming tour of Sri Lanka, scored 100 for them there. There were a couple of games that came close to result. Yorkshire were dominant against Kent but couldn't force a win on the final day. Bad light prevented them from chasing 114 from 21 overs. There were second hundreds for the season for Kent's Daniel Bell Drummond and Yorkshire's Harry Brooke, who fell six short of a first career double hundred.
Also, an amazing news from Grant Stewart.
He was on loan at Sussex last week, recalled this week,
and he was on one leg as well, had a runner and just was swinging away. So got to like about a runnable 91 and then was run out obviously roost at his crease while his runner, Jordan Cox, I think, can get to the other end in time.
It's not a bad runner to have, actually, is it?
Yeah. That one really did look like it was going to be an amazing finish, and then a sort of almost farcical bad light thing. Mm. But yeah.
Essex did well to escape with a draw against Northants. Nick Gubbins had a brilliant game against Lancashire and their A-list attack for Hampshire, hitting two hundreds, the first of which was unbeaten. Ben, who do you fancy for the title at this stage of the season?
Well, it's such a shame that last day in Hampshire Lancashire was rained out, because that looked like it was going to be a really barnstorming finish, sort of three totals that were, you know, 100 runs separating all of them, just about. Lancashire chasing 350 odd to win on the last day. We know they've got a very consistent batting line. We know that Hampshire have a brilliant bowling attack. It looked like almost like an early sort of, you know, one of those games, if it's in the Premier League, you'd say team can't win the title here, but they can lose it, sort of thing. And then it was washed out. But I'd say that those two, I mean, you look at the strength of their attacks and you look at how the batters have managed to do in those respective sides well, and you say that those two look pretty tough to beat. Surrey have also put together a pretty good run. Jamie Smith looks really, really impressive. And they also have a very good bowling attack and also a deepish one as well. I guess the question is going to be as well how England absences affect these teams. I mean, Lancashire could end up losing, well, they almost certainly will lose two players and might well lose a third if Matt Parkinson gets a call up as well. I mean, they do have some depth. I mean, the fact that Mahmood and Parkinson were both left out of the team for this game for Tom Bailey's been. Tom Bailey's, you know, one of the best county bowlers in the country. Hampshire are slightly less likely to be affected by that, with Abbas and Abbott always available and Keith Barker having a brilliant season, but again, he's not close to the frame for England section. So I'd say,
and reasonably likely, that all of their top six are not going to play for England.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we'll come to, I guess, Gubbins and Vince later, but you wouldn't say that either of those are absolutely hot favourites to be selected. There's an outside chance that either of them might get a go. But you'd say that they might well end up with that team that played in the Lancashire game basically playing for most of the season, and that is going to be a pretty tough team to beat in general, I think.
The other game I didn't mention there was the Surrey-Gloucester draw, where it was over 1,000 runs with a loss of 12 wickets across the course of the game. Jamie Smith with a double 100 for Surrey and Chris Dent with a double 100 for Gloucestershire.
Another way that people can discount Ollie Pope's runs away from the Oval there, just notching that one up already.
Well, we had a discussion in the office about whether or not Bristol... So Pope has never scored 100 north of the Thames, and Pope ended up getting 84 or something like that. And we had a discussion in the office about whether or not this would have counted as 100 that was north of the Thames, because the Bristol ground is both north and to the south of various points on the Thames in central London. So it's south of Waterloo Bridge, for example, but north of Putney Bridge.
North of the midpoint of the Thames as well, I think. But then the Oval is also north of some parts of the Thames.
Exactly.
There's no way you're going to be able to sell advertising on this pod with this level of river chat. No, I think the funny thing with Pope and the away from the over thing is, I kind of jest with it, is because I always say, like, you know, he averages like 45 away from the Oval, which is pretty decent compared to basically every other batsman in England everywhere. But it is funny that when he does go away, there is always like a way that someone who's, you know, normally kind of Essex Mafia or something manages to find out, oh, you know, actually Dan Lawrence scored 83 when he went to Bristol, which is et cetera, et cetera.
Ben, what's your moment of the week?
Well, I had a few from the Round the County Championship, actually. But in the end, what just took top spot was Harris Ralph, Yorkshire's Harris Ralph against Kent's Nathan Gilchrist. So Nathan Gilchrist, this was his fifth of six consecutive ducks, which is equal the first class record. So I'm sure that stream will have absolutely massive numbers when he comes into bat this weekend. And this one he couldn't do a huge amount with, because Harris Ralph was bowling very quickly as he can do. He hasn't played a huge amount of first class cricket, but it's been very impressive for Yorkshire so far. And just a very quick leg stump Yorker that basically took him off his feet. And there's an amazing picture by Gareth Coppy that has done the rounds. Showed Gilchrist being sort of knocked off his feet, basically, literally. So, yeah, amazing moment.
In Division 2, there was an amazing game between Glamorgan and Derbyshire, with Glamorgan finishing 310 for 8, chasing 331 on the final day, with Marnus Labuschagne and Sam Northeast nearly pulling off an epic last day run chase. Brooke Guest for Derbyshire became the first Derbyshire keeper to score centuries in both innings of a match since 1896. Elsewhere, there was a good win for Notts. Ben Duckett was in the runs again. Dane Patterson took a career best eighth, but the performance of the game was probably Ed Barnard's extraordinary 163 not out for Worcestershire that kind of kept them in the game, but it wasn't quite enough to win the game for them. Middlesex thumped Leicestershire at Lords, though Ben Mike for Leicestershire, 23-year-old all-round, had a very good game for the visitors, scoring 99 not out and taking 4 for 15.
I thought when you were discussing the Notts game, you were about to say performance of the game probably came from Stuart Broad, who smashed 47 or 25 in the first innings, and it's a first innings since the Ashes, and was cruelly deprived of the chance for an absolutely rapid 50 by 2 wickets in 4 balls, I think.
Anyway, as I mentioned earlier, we're less than a month away from the start of the Test summer. Ben, I can't remember England starting a summer with so few spots in the 11 sewn up. So Stokes and Root aside, I wouldn't say anyone is guaranteed a place in the team, I guess Bairstow as well. And I guess now we know that Anderson and Broad are back in the frame, at least one of them will probably play if available. First question on this, BJ Gorton asks, is Crawley's position untenable? Frustratingly similar mistakes to get out on test matches and a sample size to suggest that he will not exceed his moderate first class record, low scores in the county championship. Crawley averages less than 20 in the county championship this season. His first class average, if he gets a pair in his next game for Kent, his career first class average will drop below 30, and he's played over 70 matches. He's got 6 first class 100s from 70 games. At what point, obviously, there are lots of people whose opinions we all respect who really rate Zach Crawley, but at what point do you have to look at the numbers and go, he's actually had quite a few opportunities, it's not worked out for him?
He's James Vince for the TikTok generation, isn't he? It's frustrating because we can all watch him and go, yeah, that is a player right there. But equally, there's very little to back it up apart from a 267 in a test match. I mean, let's get into it. I mean, you've kind of lined me up to do the test selection kind of quick viz overview of the summer and who might play, who should play, who shouldn't. And we'll probably, we're going down that direction early. It's very difficult to find any kind of numbers or analytics or data, whatever you want to call it, based, reason to pick Zach Crawley. For the reasons that the listeners outlined there is that you go through his first class record, there's very little to be impressed by. You go through his test record and you've got the big standout knocks and you've got a couple ones in between, that last morning at Sydney and all that. You've got those flourishes, but you haven't got the body of work. And it's actually been quite a long time that he's played test cricket now. He's young, but he's got a reasonable sample size there. And you go through and you look at the main kind of markers of or predictors of success when you're looking at a first-class batter compared to a test batter or, trying to draw the line between the two. And you're looking at, obviously, averages, simple. Average against the new ball, which is really important. How often, how in control they are, which you can measure with a few different things, like you can weight runs in certain ways, or you can look at the false shots or all this kind of stuff. You can look at when they bat, who they bat against, test bowlers, look at how many other runs have been scored in the match, all those kind of stuff. There's plenty of ways of putting context on it. And there's basically none of them which support the idea that Zach Crawley is going to become a test batter. Now, that is not me saying we should not pick him, because as you say, we can all look at Zach Crawley and go, he has got something. The thing is, that something is essentially impossible to quantify. We cannot work it out. It might be because it's irrelevant. There's basically no numerical way of saying what Zach Crawley has makes a good test batter, because what Zach Crawley has is an ability to time the hell out of a cover drive and a flick through mid-wicket. Loads of people can do that. Loads of people can't. Crawley clearly stands aside from the bulk of English batters in that sense, but does that actually mean that he's going to go on and make a career in test cricket at the top of the order? Probably not. But I think this is the thing of where analytics merges with gut feel. Personally, I don't really have a problem with England picking Crawley at all for that exact reason, that you need to have a blend of number-based selections and also where you just look and go, that is it. But England have been picking him for 2 years and he's not delivered enough consistency to keep demanding selection. So where do you draw the line? It's a long way of saying I don't know, but I don't really know what else Zach Crawley can do in county cricket to get dropped, basically. He could have essentially got he could have got duck every single innings. And if he plays the first game of the summer, it doesn't seem to matter, basically.
Yeah, well, I guess there's one thing in Crawley's favour is that there aren't any other standout openers right now, really, apart from Alex Lees, obviously the incumbent, who's had a brilliant start to the season.
What does right now mean, though?
Well, as in, yes.
Last 3 weeks?
Like, yes, basically, yeah. And that is an admittedly small sample size. And so I wouldn't be hugely surprised if any one of quite a number of openers gets a score or two in the next weeks and becomes quite significantly in the frame. And one of those could be Crawley. I mean, you know, he does occasionally just produce sort of standout performances. And if that comes in the next 2 weeks, then you wouldn't have an issue. And even then, you know, even without that, there might just not be another player who all of a sudden 6 games becomes quite a big sample size. And if he has just an equivalently bad record to lots of other candidates, and, you know, we know that the people in charge of the team are a fan, and he got 100 three test matches ago and a 70 the test before that, then maybe you, or sorry, two tests before that, then maybe you have more of a case. I think the other thing to say, though, is that, like, backing and nurturing potential doesn't just have to mean picking someone over and over and over again. And there is a risk, because I think you've made this point, Yaz, before, that you get quite a lot of players who have played about the number of games that Crawley has and have about the test record he has. You don't get very many who have played sort of 5 tests more than Crawley has and have about that record. So the next chance when it comes, if it doesn't turn out to be a productive one, could kind of be the last one. You could end up saying, okay, let's give Crawley this summer because we know he's really talented and because we know he's got loads of potential. He doesn't crack it because he's not in the right form right now, and he hasn't yet learned to make the most of his talent to score those like hundreds regularly. And then all of a sudden, it actually becomes very hard to pick him again in the future when he kind of has figured that out. And actually, you see that with some of the other people that are in the frame at the moment that have kind of had a go or a couple of goes in test cricket. And maybe now they have kind of learned how to be sort of consistent enough in first class cricket that they might make a better fist of it. But that will kind of be sort of like an albatross around their neck in terms of selection.
Well, that's the skill of selection as opposed to talent ID, isn't it? You know, analytics is far more engaged with the latter of who is ready to play test cricket right now and who is likely to succeed. That's just basically working out, you know, predicting averages and predicting how well people will do if they turn up at Lord's in a couple of weeks' time. Selection is about looking long-term, medium-term, short-term, and plotting a player's career. Is it good for Zach Crawley to play this summer if he's going to basically end his career this summer, or end it for 5 years because he's going to get beaten up by players because he's not quite there yet? Is it important that Ollie Pope plays this summer, or does Ollie Pope need to go away? I think what our numbers suggest is that Ollie Pope is extraordinarily ready to play test cricket and is the standout batter aside from the established stars in test cricket, in English cricket, and probably should play. But Crawley, you can make the argument, like you say, and I've had this conversation with Will McPherson a few times, which is I don't think Crawley will ever make a case for selection in test cricket, in county cricket. He will make it in ODI cricket if he ever plays. He'll do a kind of Jason Roy, Alex Hales, where he kind of batters a load of runs in white ball and people go, geez, this guy can bat, and then they throw him back in. I don't think he's ever going to go back and make 5 tons in 7 games for Kent. I just don't think his game is suited to it, unless county cricket changes irrevocably, but I don't think that's going to happen in the, you know, within Crawley's career.
And it's also intriguing to note his struggles compared to the rest of the Kent top order as well. Like the first county games he plays after saying that averaging 35 in county cricket is a very impressive thing, and he's then struggling when Ben Compson, Daniel Bell Drummond are both sort of reeling off big scores. But we should discuss alternatives, I guess.
One more thing on Crawley is I just wonder if it's almost like his promotion to the test side, I think, happened because of the lack of alternatives. I think if Zach Crawley comes through in an era where there are more players who are obviously test cricketers around his age, he plays white ball cricket and does really well in that. I really like the Hales and Roy comparisons. Those are two players who hit really good cover drives against really fast bowling and look amazing. But yeah, Ben, you're right. We need to look at alternatives. Who do you think would you like to see at the top of the order for the first test of the summer?
Well, I think Lees has a very strong case. I mean, there was sort of a bit of sort of raised eyebrows and sort of knowing looks in the West Indies at, you know, how he shaped up and what his technique was like, but he didn't disgrace himself in terms of he regularly made it through the new ball. I think, you know, when England made that massive score in Barbados, some credit had to go to Lees for getting through what was the most testing period of the innings, and you'd hope that that is valued, because I think that's a valuable thing, even if it's not an attractive eye-catching thing. I think the primary job of the opener is to see off the new ball, and I think that he showed he can do that. I mean, there's lots of things we don't know about Lees, and I'm not saying that Lees is, you know, a world-class test opener in waiting, but that was, there was some amount of problems in that, and he has had a brilliant start to the season. He's, you know, averaging 150, albeit in Div 2, has got some big scores in there. Well, he carried us back, didn't he, for 180, which is a really, really impressive innings. And the other slot, I mean, I kind of have basically no idea, which is why I think they might well go with Crawley, because, you know, you look at other openers England have had recently, Burns and Sibley have both had equally, if not worse, starts of the season than Crawley's had. I mean, neither of them has made a 50 so far.
And Crawley does have two, as you say, two good scores in his last five tests. Exactly. And I know his average isn't great, but when there are so few options, it wouldn't be the most ridiculous thing in the world for him to stay in the seat.
Yeah, I'd be gobsmacked if he didn't play the first test of the summer for all kinds of reasons. But I think, I mean, with the selection stuff that I've done, just a little bit of, you know, back of an envelope, trying to pull together a few bits and bobs. What stands out is that, as Ben's kind of alluded to there, is that the two best opening batsmen for Test cricket in England right now are Dom Sibley and Rory Burns. They are the ones that have got that come to the fore with the numbers, and that's partly because, as you say, seeing off the new ball is crucial, and Rory Burns, his record of doing that in the county championship and in English cricket is really good. I know he's got the kind of dot 100 problem, but like, it's not a bad problem to have if you make hundreds every couple of innings. And Sibley, whilst he has his, you know, his majestic cover drive through mid wicket as his main stroke, like, he is still very good at getting through the early overs, and he doesn't ever really nick off. It's a boring point to come back to those two being the best players, but I think in the mad, you know, whirligig of last year when everything seemed to go wrong, everyone's head got a bit scrambled, and it was like, no, you know, we need to throw everything out with the bathwater and just really get, you know, we need to look ahead to Australia, and Milan can come back in the top three. It's great, let's get him in there. When actually, probably a bit of level-headed thinking and not sacking the selector halfway through the year probably sees the two best players going through to the Ashes. I know Burns didn't have a good Ashes, but good players can have bad tours. I think Lee's, by this kind of metric that I've tried to pull together, is probably England's third or fourth best. And I think when you add that to the fact that he's the incumbent, did a decent job, and neither Sibley or Burns are banging the door down. I think, again, there's an element of like, just because the numbers say that this guy is the best in the abstract, is this the right time to pick him? I'm not sure it definitely is.
I touched on something quite interesting in that normally when you pick a Test cricket team, you're almost picking a side for a year. You're like really backing players. But when you don't have an obvious best two openers, then picking it on form does actually make sense, right? Like, you're not making a decision on this guy is the best opener we definitely have. If it's not much of a gap between 1, 2, 3, and 4, it's fine to kind of pick.
Yeah,
on form,
definitely.
Isn't it?
If you're going that within that kind of range of like, you're not just going, you know, Brett De Oliveira made a double last week, get him in. If it's like guys who are on your radar, which obviously they are. England have got depth charts, you know, all over the wall at Loughborough, and they'll be saying, you know, this guy's the eighth best, and actually he's smashing it. Get him in. I think there's a logic to that, because you're giving a player the best chance to succeed potentially. But yeah, that's that again, it's that tension that comes between picking the best players and picking them at the right time. But yeah, I think I'd probably go Crawley and Lees just because of Burns and Sibley's form. But personally, if you put a gun to my head and said who's likeliest to succeed, I'd go Burns and Sibley.
Yeah, I guess the thing is that you rightly point to heads being scrambled and, you know, it having been a very rough time to be in that Test environment, that sort of thing. But I think you then need to see evidence that their heads have become unscrambled, basically, which we haven't yet seen. And we know that both have done some work on their techniques, and that can need some time to bed in and that sort of thing. And
I more meant administrative heads that are now no longer there.
Right.
But that have since rolled.
but then I guess, you know, you see players when they're in a struggling team and they're struggling for form themselves, and you basically, it's very, very rare to see a batter who has knocked a bang down the door in county cricket to win Test selection struggle, then get dropped. They rarely go back and are as successful in county cricket straight away, and so you kind of need to, I think, wait until they earn a recall, basically. And it's not just because, you know, it's like a punishment for being dropped, it's just that you like, that has an effect on how good a player someone is.
Absolutely. And it's important, obviously, for, you know, county cricket as a whole to see that there's a pathway into the team. You can't just be a yo-yoing back and forth in and out of the side. Suddenly it's the 90s again.
But, and to illustrate sort of how bare the cupboard is in a way, like, I was trying to think of who the other alternatives are. I guess you have Tom Haynes at Sussex, who is very young, never faced a ball in Division 1, but has, you know, he scores a lot of runs, he shapes up pretty well, but as I say, that would be a massive punt. You've got, I guess, Chris Dent at Gloucestershire, who the Gloucestershire fans tell you should have played for England by now, has a first class average above 40, which is impressive. You know, a few seasons ago, you would have probably said he's maybe close than he is now, but...
Slightly below 40, but yeah, still okay, very good.
Had a poor year last year, has had a good start to the county season, but he's had sort of, in his first few games, had a failure and a low 50 in each one, so he's averaging about 30 coming into his most recent game and gets that double 100, which obviously is impressive, but that is in a game where 1,000 for 12 was scored. So that's, I don't know if that suggests that he is a test opener right now. But and then you've got possibly someone like James Bracey or Nick Gubbins.
Well, Bracey was the guy I was going to say, and it comes back to the madness of last year and the way that certain players were handled. You know, Bracey was probably the next cab off the rank, gets played out of position, and then it's seemingly in the dark again. I think he's a guy who, if he'd have had a cracking start to the season and was getting a bit of momentum behind him, then I think I'd be pushing. I know he's more of a three than an opener, but
that's the thing.
But again, you know, at this stage, is there really that much of a difference? I know people say Raul Dravid, et cetera, but come on, we're not talking about that caliber of player here.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Bracey, he's had a pretty good start to the season. He got that 100 in the Lions game, 100 in his first two games, struggled his last two. But, you know, with another score, he's all of a sudden got 300s and is one of the standout bats in the country. I could see that happening. Gubbins, that was just one game, but those were 200s against a massively skilled Lancashire attack. So that means a fair amount. And, okay, it was a long time ago, but he was at one point the next cab off the rank for an opening slot. And I think someone who has that declines and then comes back, you can want to pick them at the right time. I'm not saying Gubbins for England, but I'm saying this is actually kind of how bare the cupboard is that I don't think before the season anyone would have been shouting for Nick Gubbins to get a go in the first test of the summer. And now all of a sudden, he's kind of one of not very many realistic, like even semi-realistic options.
Yeah, he's the guy you'd get on, like, Gubbins is like the guy you'd get 10th on a list of guys who might open for England in 6 months. And it's when you know, Jerno has gone, geez, I need someone to round out my numbers. He can't have an article with 7. So it's like, I think it's that level of like flyer. I think we all kind of respect the idea of the next cab off the rank at some point is an indication of a deeper run of form. You know, people come in and out, and I think that is a good way to go. But equally, you can end up, you know, I remember listening to this podcast last year when Yaz was trying to get Adam Knife to open for England, and it's like that can happen. Just because you recognize a player, you value their hundreds a little bit more wisely. And that's not me saying Ali or for England though, but.
Dan Lawrence batted 4 for England in the Caribbean. We don't know whether Root will bat 3 or 4 yet this summer, but someone needs to bat at either 3 or 4, wherever Root doesn't bat. Ben, who would you like to see? Obviously, it's slightly different depending on where Root bats. If Root bats, let's say Root goes back to 4, who would you like to see at 3?
Yeah, this is the one I'll get criticised for. So I'm already like feeling creepy about saying it. But I think Josh Bohannon should probably be batting 3 for England this summer, or 4 behind Joe Root. I know he's not played much first-class cricket, but we're talking about how bare the cupboard is. We're talking about how few legitimate top-order options there are. Bohannon's numbers are extremely good, both in a very simplistic sense of scorecard numbers, but also his deeper numbers of control and you know, contact numbers, and his numbers in very particular areas. You know, good length record, new ball record, all this kind of stuff. You know, he's one of the best players of the new ball in the country, and that's partly because he's facing a slightly older version of it, but it's still the new ball. And we talk about how the Duke's ball swings around all day. I think it does matter, and I think. You know, I know this podcast is basically get the Lancashire team in the England squad podcast, but I think Bohannon is probably a slightly less sexy version of the Parkinson agenda, in that this guy is, I think he is just really good, and he is probably slightly ahead of the curve in terms of being picked. He's probably one for next year in an ideal world, but we're not in an ideal world. We're in a Red Bull reset, and we've got a new captain, and no one in England can bat. So yeah. I think if you're taking a punt and we're looking for these flyers, I don't mind someone like a Bohannon whose underlying numbers are really, really good.
So what are control numbers? You mentioned a couple of statistical things there.
So that's to do with either false shot percentage, which is basically what it sounds like. How often do you edge or play a miss, which is a relatively solid indicator of how many runs you will score, how, you know, your batting average in Red Bull cricket, or contact average, which is a slightly more sophisticated version of it, which is where you kind of weight runs that are scored with a good connection, i.e. like a middle cover drive for 4, you give a little bit more weighting than a nick through the slips for 4.
So a way of quantifying like a streaky 100.
Yeah, it's the difference between a chanceless 100 and someone who's come out and whacked 120 on day four of a drawn game when it's 1,000 for 2. It's that kind of thing.
And am I right thing to say, because contact, that's different to the timing rating, which is about how many of your cover drives go for 4, essentially.
Timing rating, in essence, it's to do with, it's basically the white ball version of that figure. So in white ball cricket, we talk about guys like Shubman Gill and Virat Kohli have incredible timing ratings, which is basically they never edge the ball in white ball cricket, and it doesn't necessarily translate. In fact, it often translates to not being good at T20 cricket. More of that later. But I think in red ball cricket, it's essentially the best indicator, unless you've got very deep metrics in terms of tracking data and all this kind of stuff and second 11 and, you know, how well they batted when they were nine against Bolton under twos or whatever. But like they having that knowledge of how they score their runs is really valuable, I think, in terms of being predictive. And that's been shown over a relatively long period of time. And Bahanan is someone who does really well by those numbers. So I've kind of got to stand by it. Otherwise, I'm going to get done by the lads in the office. So.
No, I think he's got a compelling case. I mean, he averages pretty much 47, 48 first class cricket. My only reservation with Bahanan is that he's only scored 4 first class hundreds. That's because he just hasn't played that much. Yeah, I mean, like England are coming up against 2 really good attacks this summer, and ideally you'd want more, you know, a greater body of work before you make your test debut, but England can't really.
So who else is the option?
So I've got a few names, and I guess it also comes down to sort of like a philosophy of selection thing where, and I think England have done the Bahanan type pick quite a lot, where you pick someone based on often it's just like it's a few seasons of like okay run scoring to be like, as you say, 10th on one of those lists, and then a very a bumper season, and then it's like, okay, let's get this guy in now.
Simply trajectory.
Yeah, exactly. Or even, yeah, there's a few guys you could put in that category, and Bahanan would be in that. And you think like, well, this guy could be, you know, a guy who can average 40, 45 and like really take our testing to the next level. Or you go for a player who you kind of, you know, that like they've done like pretty well for quite a long time, but you've maybe seen them before. So the three guys who would be in that category, I think, would be Ben Duckett, Dawid Malan and James Vince, all of whom have had decent starts the season, all of whom have, like, you know, shown flashes in at the international level of what they can do, and all of whom have actually had pretty good or really kind of very good numbers in terms of the English metric, in terms of averaging like 40 or thereabouts for like quite a long time. And so I think any of those, but I guess the thing is that even with those guys, there's no guarantee of even like a decent level of returns. I mean, like you look at, you know, all of them average less than 30 in test cricket. You look at Milan, sort of, you could say that, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on in that Ashes tour, as we've discussed. He had more than anyone else with his wife heavily pregnant, ended up having quite a difficult birth, which was during that last test. And he actually did a very good interview with, I think it might have been Simon Wilde in the Times, where he talked about that last test where, you know, his wife had a premature birth and the baby was sort of in hospital in the ICU, I think.
Just can't imagine it. How'd you play cricket?
He talked about a text exchange with Collingwood, where Collingwood said, give it all you've got. And Milan was like, to be honest, the tank is just empty. And so I think you do have to take a pinch of salt those last three tests. And he, before that, you know, he looked like a guy that was kind of what England had been looking for in that number three slot, of a guy who was supporting Joe Root. They'd had quite a lot of quite big partnerships, Root Clee, like batting with him. So any of those guys, I think, possibly could come in and not disgrace themselves. But I think we also know they're not going to be the guy that comes in and takes England's test team to, you know, a position where it can compete home and away with New Zealand, India, Australia, probably Pakistan. So I guess it's about like the ceiling versus the floor kind of thing.
Duckett's control numbers are surprisingly good for like a guy who plays a lot of white ball cricket. Obviously, I know he's a red ball player and his red ball record is really strong, but you still think you're probably going to be owing more towards a kind of flary player. But he's controlled, and he also has a very good record against the new ball. I think he'd be a bolter if he does keep things going. I mean, I think I said last summer, very, very kind of halfway through a Welsh Fire game at the Oval, saying this guy plays a test this summer. You know, we'd all had a few. But at the same time, I think he's closer to test selection than, you know, some people probably think, because he is a talent in that form of the game. And I think Milan is probably a little bit more of like just a kind of proven player. You know what you're going to get. And he's almost like a kind of slightly deluxe Joe Denley of like, he gets us through the next year and then we bring through the next guy, be that Bahanan or be that Duckett in 12 months. And I think that there's logic to that selection. Who was the third guy you mentioned?
Well, it was Vince. He doesn't bat 3 in county cricket and is, know, he's James.
I can't believe I forgot Vince. I've stayed up all night. You know, there's it's that scene in Always Sunny where it's just like the guy in front of all the post-it notes, and like I cannot make James Vince's compelling case to be in the side. He is he's just so uncontrolled these days. Like he's basically a parody of the guy who, when he was gone, who basically he would nick off occasionally, but more so when he's facing Mitchell Starc at 95 mile an hour. Whereas now his numbers are, his deeper line numbers just aren't very good.
And even that 100 he got was sort of like a better than a runner ball, sort of like counter attack on quite a flat pitch.
I mean, I still want to marry it. Yeah. Like, it's still incredible. And I would love to see him given a go. Maybe Rob Key's got an eye on that in terms of, you know, that's going to be like his Joss Butler pick when Smith came in. I know he's not selected, but you know what I mean? And that, you never quite account for taste in this kind of thing. But yeah, sadly, I can't make that as much as I'd like to.
Duckett is... His numbers are really good, but he bats in a way that's very different to how you'd imagine your number three batting in Test cricket. I mean, he had this really good game against Worcester this week, striking, I think, above 100 in both innings on a very green wicket with one incredibly small boundary. I mean, I spoke to Duckett at the start of the year, and he made a point not too dissimilar to what Crawley said, the famous, you're doing well to average 35. He was saying that knots, they know that a very good way of them getting results is having pitches where, you know, it's 200 plays 250 and they've got lots of good young batters there and they're kind of fine averaging 35 if they win games. But, you know, do you bat like that on a flat one against a really good attack? Probably not. And, you know, there's a lot of chat about how different county cricket is to Test cricket. I'd say scoring 120 runs off 110 balls in a game in Div 2 on a green pitch is just so different to Test cricket. Just quickly, we don't know if there will be another spot slot in the middle order. It might be that Bairstow takes a glove at 7 and there's a spot at 5, or Folk stays at 7 and Bairstow bats at 5. But if it is Bairstow dropping down to bat 7 and there's a spot at 5, who would you like to see?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you said that. So our numbers basically identified that, you know, and people will not like this, but in terms of what you actually project the returns to be, between Folks, Butler and Bairstow, there's actually very little in it. But, you know, we probably expect, you know, in terms of looking at the red ball numbers, Butler to probably do the best, Bairstow to do slightly less, and Folks to do slightly less. But equally, that's just batting. So you're not accounting for Folks's slightly better goal.
You've got to always pick your best keeper, though.
You've got to pick your best keeper at the end of the day. So, yeah. And the other guy who came up really well in our numbers is Alex Davies, which is quite interesting because, obviously, again, a guy who's kind of been around, probably a tier below next cab off the rank, but he's a guy who's got good control numbers, you know, decent record, decent underlying numbers. So I think basically England have got, you know, the problem of this England side is not who bats number 7. They've got some cracking players there. But let's say Bairstow.
And you've not even mentioned Ben Brown.
I've not even mentioned Ben Brown, who did also come out very well. But yeah, Joe's not here to push his case or to have his case pushed for him by Ben. I think the interesting names that kind of come up are in the middle order, if you're thinking Stokes at 6, looking at the number 5 position, it's Ollie Pope. Ollie Pope is the standout player in England. There is no one better than him. And that is unequivocal. If you are going to try and win games now, you pick Ollie Pope. That is where we are going. However, there are guys who offer an alternative if England wants to say to Ollie Pope, go and play, you know, go and play some white ball cricket, free yourself up, have a summer of just hanging around in Clapham and just doing oval things rather than, you know, trekking around the country, maybe not playing every game. But the standout name that comes up is Harry Brook. And I know he's young and I know he's come through recently, but again, a bit like Bohannon, there's just so much there to like in terms of the control, the record when he gets the opportunity to face the new ball, the underlying numbers are outstanding. And the fact that he's also done it in white ball cricket, I know that's not an indicator of success. And that genuinely is true, that in terms of predicting red ball success, white ball success has not really anything to do with it. But there is an encouraging element of someone being able to dominate the 100, which is, you know, a very high standard of domestic cricket.
PSL as well.
And then he goes to the PSL and plays brilliantly as well. And I know he had a shocker of a BBL in between. But at the same time, I think there's a feel of a guy who's coming to the fore. And I would very much still pick Ollie Pope. There's no question about that. But Brook's a really interesting alternative.
What's happened to... Why hasn't Ollie Pope cracked it?
I think partly because he naturally is very aggressive. He's an aggressive player who, as a result, is going to fail slightly more often than lower heartbeat, more defensive players, just because he's going to give a few more chances. And as a result, things are going to go a bit wrong. I think he's had the misfortune of being of playing in a slightly ropey side. And you want, you know, I think Ollie Pepper's an incredible number six when he's coming in at 300 for 4, but who isn't an incredible number six at that point? But I think Pope's often been a firefighter, and we saw from his first stint in Test cricket that he's not a top order player. That's not his game. He's Michael Clarke. He's not Ian Bell. He's not that kind of stylish guy, but who's got a bit of grit. He is flary. He is a bit weird. I would say there isn't, apart from all the stuff about guards, and I know that Butch isn't here, so I don't want to even mention the idea of an off-stump guard, but I think that shows that he has been tweaked, he has techniques been tweaked around, and I think that's not necessarily an indication of a guy who's been backed to the hilt by the people in charge. And the fact that, you know, he flew out his batting coach in the winter and all this kind of stuff, it doesn't suggest a particularly supportive environment. I think he's the kind of guy, and I know nothing about him in terms of a presence in the dressing room, and I think Zach Crawley's far more likely to fill this position if you listen to the whispers and the rumours. But he's the kind of guy who you almost want to say, you're now vice captain, you play the next 20 tests, you are absolutely locked in, please just make some runs. And at that, but I'm not willing to write him off yet, and I'm not willing to send him to the Shires, because the guys we're talking about who are going to replace him in the side are not that good, unless you go for Bairstow to five and then Folkes or Butler at number seven. I am going to keep saying Folkes or Butler because I don't want Joss Butler's test career to be over as much as it seems to have been the rights have been cast. It's he's still basically as good as the options that England have got.
One other thing I guess you'd say about Pope, and to an extent you can probably do this with any player, but you can find sort of mitigation just if you run through how his career has progressed in terms of when you look at 20 tests, average below 30. That is bad. Obviously, he's not been the player that we think he could be. But, you know, so you got those first two tests when he was very, very young. Okay, so perhaps you can set them aside. Then you've got the recall when actually he did well to very well to begin with, you know, got a 70 when keeping that second test, got that brilliant 100 in what is fourth or fifth test on recall. Had an okay summer after that, but it wasn't as good as he could have been. But that was still, that's the kind of the consolidating summer that someone has in a kind of weird environment. Still played some very, very good innings in that time. Got a brilliant, was it a 90 odd against Pakistan, I think? So that, and at that point you think, okay, this guy, he's very, very close to cracking it. Then he muffs up his shoulder and then gets recalled in India, having not actually played any competitive cricket for like, is it 8 months or 6 months? Because he's had this pretty bad injury, and also having had an injury, you'd expect, you know, you can't even be training, you can't be hitting balls. So it comes back inside at that point and on surfaces which were doing absolutely loads, and that will just set you back quite a long way. And then you have again like a in and out of the side a few times during the summer, and then in the Ashes again was what was recalled at the end of the Ashes, when you're like, this guy's, you know, he was dropped for his own good and has been recalled because of no one else.
I'm
not saying that, you know, other players would have been able to work through all those things and get those things, so it's not total mitigation. But you can also say this isn't a guy who's just had, you know, 20 tests in a row and has come out averaging less than 30 on all pitches where other people have been able to score runs and that sort of thing. There is some mitigation there, I guess.
That is true, but I guess with Pope, I think no one would disagree with what Ben's saying, that he is the standout batter outside of Root and Stokes in England. But part of becoming a excellent international player is dealing with extremely challenging environments, and he hasn't been able to yet. A lot of the examples you bring up there are completely fair, but equally, it wasn't impossible to score runs in those situations.
But also, I think it's important to realise, we're not talking in generalities here or like kind of just vague things about like, you know, Pope's the best. Like if Pope was just slightly better than, or like even just, you know, quite a lot better than the next best option, and he's failed for 25 tests in it, and then you go, okay, well, he needs a good dropping, that guy, back to county cricket, go make some runs, lad. He is so far ahead of everyone else that it almost makes a mockery of it. There is no reason to not have him in the side. He is just so much better. And the question you almost have to ask is, it's more structural. I think Ollie Pope's success and failure, or failure in inverted commas, is more existential for English cricket than should he be in the test side. It's why can a guy be that good there and that bad there? We're not talking about Ram Prakash not failing to step up, or failing to step up in the 90s and the early 2000s, or, you know, this isn't a Graham Hick thing. This is a guy who is young, is coming through, is consistently making runs, and then not
being given the right chances or being used in the wrong way. He's been blooded at the wrong times. I just think there's a concern that Ollie Pope is potentially the best spotlight on what is wrong with county cricket, if you know what I mean, in terms of how do you score your runs here, how do you score your runs in Test cricket, how do you score your runs at the Oval, it's just so messy. His career is messy right now, and it shouldn't be. He should be serenely working his way like Cam Green to 10,000 runs.
And also, and this is Jesus' stick to beat him with, but he is an exception to the rule that I talked about earlier with players who get dropped not being able to, you know, get back to their previous best in county cricket. Whenever he plays for Surrey, he just gets loads and loads of runs. And this is, I mean, obviously the Oval thing, there is something in that, and he does average 100 there, and he does have a lot of his career 100 there. But also, even away from the Oval, he is is average second to Behan, I think, among all English first class players. Obviously,
It's last 4 or 5 years. The like third or fourth best English batsman is Ollie Pope away from the Oval.
Yeah, so.
What do you want him to do, lads?
It's overstated. But we haven't mentioned Dan Lawrence, who's had a tough start to the season, has had injury issues as well. So he made a 91 two tests ago. Again, I almost think in normal times, he might well just get that first test, but it's a kind of a last chance thing before you do have to go back and score some runs. But I'd say he's probably behind those two in the pecking order, would be my sort of gut feel for how that's going to go. But it's... He will also be in the reckoning, I think, come that selection meeting.
I should say, I know we need to move on, but Dan Lawrence is interesting because I think a lot of people maybe bracket him in the same way as Crawley, as like a kind of flary guy who looks great and he's got a bit about him and like, oh yeah, you look, you know, there's something, there's an aesthetic appeal more necessarily than a scorecard appeal. But he actually does really well by all our numbers in terms of, you know, different models. Not incredibly well, like not off the chart, kind of punching the door down. But he consistently scores enough runs in low scoring games, which I know is a problem in and of itself, but you can only score on what's put in front of you. And he's controlled enough, and he backs it up with underlying numbers enough. I just think it's interesting that just because a player looks good and has a bit about him and is from a state school doesn't necessarily mean they're a scrapper whose qualities can't be defined by raw number or by basic numbers. It's actually, no, he is quite good at batting and probably should be very much in contention. I think he would be hard done by if Brooke leapt ahead of him already, as much as I'd like to see Brooke.
That is interesting.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house, everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Moving on to the IPL, we've got a question from ESPN Quick Info's Matt Roller. What's behind Johnny Bairstow's poor run in T20 cricket, and how much should he play in each format this year with the T20 World Cup in October? Bairstow is averaging 11 and striking 105 in this year's IPL after not a great T20 World Cup. Surely it's not as simple as whenever he gets good in red ball cricket, white ball cricket goes completely opposite direction.
I think it is. And I, you know, I've been on the show a huge number of times, and you all know I love Bairstow. I think he's amazing. I think he's an underrated red ball player because he's been used in wrong positions, and an underrated great of white ball cricket. But there is a straightforward fact that his successes don't overlap. You know, he basically he takes a holiday from one format, dominates the other, and then vice versa. And yeah, you look at his numbers. Basically, his last. It's almost comical that like his last positive impact, which is cricket's measure for basically like better than the average, better than what you'd expect in T20 cricket, his last positively impacting series or tournament or competition was the 100, which is the last thing he played before he came back into the test side. And all of a sudden since then, he's had a bad World Cup, he didn't succeed, he hasn't had a good IPL, and you can see that he just isn't quite the same player. He's not
good against. He's not struggling against either pace or spin particularly. He's struggled massively against pace in this IPL particularly. He's averaging 9, but he's scoring, more importantly, like a runner ball against both. There is something fundamentally wrong with his overall game rather than a kind of specific issue. I think what is maybe at play, and I'm hesitant to blame it, because at the time I was a big fan of the move, was obviously England moved Bairstow from the top of the order to number 4 because they basically realised they had two of the same player in Bairstow and Butler in T20 cricket. They wanted Butler to open, but they also wanted Jason Roy's rapid start, and they wanted Bairstow to dominate spin through the middle. They go to South Africa, Bairstow does brilliantly in that role. And that is a really, really hard role to play. It's probably the hardest role in T20 cricket, batting 4, because you've kind of got to be a bit of both. But then since then, he is instinctively an opener. We've seen it in ODI cricket. That's how he kind of gets his juices flowing. He comes out, you know, cross-batted 4s through the infield, and he's off to a flyer while everyone's in. And then once he's set, that's when he hits into out and he can smack leg spin out of the ground. I think, in retrospect, it was kind of remarkable that he did so well being thrown in at number 4, which is where he's been batting for Punjab Kings as well, in this ongoing IPL where he struggled. And then they promoted him to open last night as we speak, and he did badly again. But, you know, small sample size and all that. And he'll probably come good for the end of the year as long as Punjab don't go out, which they probably will. But then I basically just don't really understand, going into the summer, what England do with him. Personally, I think they need him more in T20 cricket than in Test cricket. And that's not because they're overloaded with brilliant options in Test cricket in terms of batting, but we spoke about the great options they've got for keepers down the order. And I think, do you want Bairstow to be blocking the progression of Brook, Bohannon, Lawrence, Pope? I know we don't want to look too long term, and there's that sticking plaster element of stop the bleeding first and then we'll look to the future. But, you know, Bairstow is hugely important to how England do in the T20 World Cup in, you know, 6 months' time. They need him through the middle to be in that number 3 position. Stokes is moving increasingly away from the T20 side. Milan is maybe moving away from it as well. You still need a number 3. Bairstow probably is the most natural number 3 there, Moeen at 4 and all that. So you probably need Bairstow in T20 cricket to be at his best if England are going to win the World Cup. How do you prioritise that? Do you drop him from the test team and tell him to go and score runs in the 100? I don't know. Is that
he's not going to take it particularly well after scoring 200s in the last?
Well, no, but at
tests.
The same time, if that's where strong leadership comes in. I'm not saying that's the right decision, by the way. I'm just saying that's where your MDs and your chief selectors and your coaches need to show their mettle and say, no, this is for the good of the game. I guess it's probably also a decent case for why you need one coach, not two, because if you're the Red Bull coach saying, Johnny, you've just scored 200s in a couple of tests, sorry mate, we want you to go and play the hundy, it's not going to go down well for anyone. So I don't know, again, it's very messy. The best all of England's lower middle order selection debates are grubby and confusing and contorting in on themselves at this point.
If I had to make a choice between White Ball Bairstow and Test Bairstow, I'd pick Test Bairstow. I think I'd take a lot of what you're saying, but I do think that England that they do just have lots more good White Ball players than they have Test players. And I think obviously Bairstow, his overall record and how his numbers have come out will be based on that sort of those years of wildly fluctuating Test form. But he, along with Root and Stokes, is like, he's one of the three batters England have got at the moment who have ever been anywhere near world class in Test cricket, which he was in 2016. And if it is the fact that, you know, if he's not playing white ball cricket, he can be a world class Test batter, then that is much. England have lots of other white ball players who could, or they have other white ball players who could be world class. They just don't have anyone who has anywhere who has shown they have close to the ceiling that Bairstow has. If he goes back down to, if that's what they choose to do, goes back down to number 7 and has the same form that he had in that 2016 summer, then England all of a sudden have a very well-functioning middle to lower middle order, and that is a hugely valuable thing. And I think also, even from a point of view of what is most important to English cricket, I think that actually them being even just like a competent Test side in a way is better than them even winning the T20 World Cup, just in terms of what the public care about, what people engage with and that sort of thing. I think that is a more valuable thing if you were to choose one of those two things as well. So I would go with Bairstow in Test cricket if you had to make the choice. But I would also just give him a bit longer to see if he can work it out, because it's quite easy to think in these binaries. But I think you end up giving him some white ball cricket and probably make a decision quite close to the T20 World Cup while trying to have the best of both worlds until then.
And also, he's not really had the opportunity to play much ODI cricket, which is his best format. So the opportunity for him to, and obviously just naturally, it's a bit of a mix of the two. Obviously it's more T20, but there's a sense that that is his opportunity where he gets his form for both and kind of draws his energy from. And so you can make a case that having a decent run of some ODI cricket would give him the confidence to maybe get a bit of game back in both. And then we'll see where we go. Suddenly you've got an all format Bairstow, which is, as much as people like to take the mick, an incredibly valuable thing for English cricket.
Absolutely.
IPL chat, wasn't it?
Great IPL chat.
But the big news from the IPL this week was that MS Dhoni has taken over the CSK captaincy from Ravindra Jadeja. It hasn't been going great for CSK. Jadeja's not had a great IPL.
Immediately promoted himself number three as well, and then scored 8 or 7, I think.
Absolute stinker. I mean, he's had a couple of good knocks, actually, which is pretty impressive, really. I think the Dhoni thing is interesting because it kind of, I think the retention, his retention massively hampered CSK, obviously, because he's not an elite T20 player. He's not really worth anywhere near the amount of money that they retained him for. And so the retention value was probably in his captaincy. And then he take the captaincy off him, or he gives up the captaincy, and all of a sudden it's like, hang on, so we've retained you for all that money. And I know obviously it's the IPL, there's various other things flying around, but at the same time, it did suddenly seem like that's not really fair on Jadeja to have, you know, put him in this situation. And so in a way, it's kind of good that he's taken the reins back and kind of taken a bit of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're mathematically out of it at this stage. They're still kind of in with a puncher's chance, but they would have to punch everyone.
Get on with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they've just not really clicked in the same way as Mumbai. It's nice to see the big boys not having a great year for once.
Ben, there was in the KKR Rajasthan game the other day, there was a modicum of controversy with Rajasthan not happy with some of the wide calls. Is there a lack of consistency over wide calls in T20 cricket?
I think you say there's consistency. I think you probably argue that it's not consistent with how the laws are written, I suppose. I think that in general, it almost doesn't seem, if a batter moves about too much, those guidelines are the guidelines that they stick to generally. And you could argue that is unfair on the bowlers and perhaps removes a slight tactical element where if a batter moves way across the offside, why shouldn't you be able to pitch it just on the cut strip and be a distance outside of it but still hittable when they get there? That sounds like quite clever bowling to me, but was the kind of thing that was being punished, I suppose. So there's an update to the laws coming in October, which won't deal with this directly, but you wonder if the fact that it addresses batters moving about could empower umpires to have a bit more subjectivity here. The change to the laws will be that, so what we see sometimes at the moment is a batter will step outside leg stump as if they're going to open up the offside. So a bowler will spear in at where the toes are. The batter will then step back inside the line, and as the laws are currently written, that should be a wide. The law change will be that if it would have kind of passed down the line of the batter where they were at any point during the bowler's run-up, then that should not be a wide. It'll be interesting to see if that has an impact. There's also debate over should teams be able to review wides. I wouldn't have a huge problem with that, but I would also say that generally with DRS reviews, the third umpire only takes a decision on statements of fact, basically. So if the technology says there is an edge, or the technology says this ball would have passed over the stumps, and wide calls, especially the ones outside off, will always have an element of subjectivity. Yeah. So it would be a change to how the DRS.
Well, could you not change that by just? I'm thinking off the top of my head here. As much as I've said that I think you should be able to review wides, I guess there needs to be another stage. And yeah, I mean, maybe just giving bowlers a little bit more wiggle room, but removing the importance of where a batsman goes and then saying it's just binary. So just drawing two lines, the batsman can go wherever they want. Mm-hmm. And then if the ball goes outside that, according to, you know, the Y coordinate of this Hawkeye ball is -0.3 or whatever, that means it's a wide. It doesn't matter what the batsman does. And I know there'll be issues with that and it would go wrong for a bit, but I think it's frustrating watching, you know, we saw it in the World Cup final. And because it was about the eighth most controversial decision within the last 10 minutes of that game, it didn't really get talked about. But it massively influences white ball games. You know, we're talking like huge swings, like 5-6% swings at the end of games. And it's within our power to change it. So I think we should be trying to do a little bit more.
Yeah, I don't have an issue with that. I guess the thing is that it just would be a step away from what just the laws currently say, where, you know, those lines are, as in the playing conditions, they are guidelines. They are not where wides have to be. And laws are, the laws at the moment tell umpires to make a subjective call on if a batter could have hit the ball. If you say, no, it's X wide of leg stump and X wide of off stump, and that's what a wide is, that would be, you could definitely do that with Hawkeye on DRS, that would be completely fine, but it would just be a change from what cricket is. And cricket tournaments don't generally take that kind of leap away from the laws. There's occasionally slight tweaks, but nothing.
I mean, I'll tell you who could do it is the 100, because they've led, you know, they've obviously led the way on a couple of rules that have then been shown to be better than the existing rules, and the ICC have taken them on board. So there's an element, the 100 kind of has that veneer of, you know, we're allowed to be a bit more experimental.
But those are also still generally driven by the MCC, I guess. Yeah, and the other thing is that this would be a change which would... If the MCC laws all of a sudden have like a distance wide of off and leg stump, firstly, that wouldn't really work for test or first class cricket, where you always have a much more lenience down the leg size. So you'd have to have different laws for those things. And also, it would be very, very hard to say in recreational cricket, when obviously you don't have Hawkeye, you often don't have even the guidelines painted, that would then you have basically a different set of laws, professional and recreational cricket, which is not the case at the moment. So there would be issues too. I'm not saying I'm against it, but those would be the stumbling blocks, I suppose.
Don't you think we're moving on without me mentioning my moment of the week? Yes, I can see you looking to wrap up.
No, I was literally about to ask you.
So my moment of the week was Gujarat played Sunrisers last week. I think it was on the day that the last podcast came out. I checked to make sure it counted and was legitimate. Basically, Gujarat had slightly mucked up a chase, as they have been wont to do. They've been in this kind of mad, chaotic side who just can't stop winning games in really stupid, weird ways. And then basically they were coming up against Sunrisers in the last over, had to defend 22 with Marco Jansen, big left armer, who's, you know, relatively reliable at the death, but not necessarily absolutely proven. And they had Rashid Khan and Rahul Tuatia at the crease. Obviously, Tuatia has this history of improbable kind of comebacks. He's had one this season against Punjab, and then the famous one against Punjab as well. But then he came in and hits the first ball for six, and then Rashid Khan gets on strike, and then hits the boundaries for the rest of the over that get them to this chasing 22. And it's remarkable. And every six goes about a millimetre over the fielder on the rope, including the last one, which wins them the game. And Ian Bishop's going absolutely mad on commentary. And it's one of those ones where, for me, Gujarat's success this season kind of sums up what's been good about the expansion to 10 teams, but also what's been, you know, less satisfying about it. I hesitate to say bad, because I think you're going to publish this. And so... Gujarat are a weird team. They've got lots of players who are like not great, kind of slightly, you know, scrubs in terms of, you know, the stars and scrub structure of it. But they've also got Shubman Gill and Hardik Pandya, Rahul Tuatia, and David Miller stood up, Lockie Ferguson, Mohammed Shami. They've all won games, and they've all kind of, you know, in their moments, grabbed games by the scruff of the neck and dragged Gujarat to this incredible start. I think they won 8 of their first 9 matches. But I think it's partly great because they're a new side and they've been given this blank canvas for, you know, Gary Kirsten to kind of paint his vision of what a T20 side could look like. And, you know, he's got the balance with Hardik in there when he's fit. And, you know, the obvious genius of Rashid Khan and Mohammed Shami, who's this incredibly improved new ball bowler. But then you've got these guys who are kind of also rams around him, like David Miller's suddenly getting a full IPL season. And we've seen that actually the quality is there to sustain it with the overseas players. But we're also seeing with some of the domestic guys around that there isn't necessarily that proven tier below it. And so what we've seen is this tournament has been probably the lowest quality IPL yet in terms of the actual cricket played. But the competition has been more exciting, I think, as a result, because the difference between the first and last, or first and eighth, probably because Mumbai have been atrocious, that has really dragged everyone together, I think. And it's made, you know, as we speak, We're ahead of the RCB Chennai game, and if RCB win that, then it's an absolute dogfight for the playoffs. And we're talking about, you know, four or five teams going for two places. Rajasthan could still fall back into it. You know, it could be an incredibly tight finish to a season, which, if you're looking at from the IPL supremacy point of view of like, it's just the best cricket in the world, it's actually probably closer to PSL cricket, you know, the next best league, than it's ever been, with the PSL getting better and the IPL getting slightly worse. But it's still such an incredibly exciting tournament to watch because of that increase in competition between the sides.
Mm. No, that is interesting. You also wrote a really good piece this week on Tim David and how we generate hype for players. Do you want to kind of expand on the gist of what you were saying?
Well, the gist of it was is that I did every podcast going before the IPL saying how great it was that Tim David was going to get a gig and how he was going to tear it up. And then Mumbai dropped him after two games and I looked like a right mug. But basically, the piece was just about the idea that, you know, Tim David has been the best T20 batsman in the world, according to our numbers, for 12 months before the IPL auction. He gets signed by Mumbai. It's a great moment for a guy who's not played, doesn't play first class cricket, doesn't really play list A cricket. He's kind of come through as a specialist T20 player. Obviously, he's, you know, this mix of like the Singaporean and Australian thing, but there's kind of an associate glean. It's a great story. And he comes in and then he goes in and he's the next big thing. And then Mumbai lose patience with him after two games because they want to play with their new toy that they've got, which is an 18-year-old South African called Dewa Brevis, who is even more the next big thing, who's torn up the Under-19 World Cup and is clearly incredibly talented, but is also got this kind of boost to his reputation of looking a bit like AB de Villiers and saying he wants to be AB de Villiers and having the name Baby AB. And it just struck a chord with me that T20 cricket, and particularly the focus on IPL cricket, is so driven these days by, not agendas, because that sounds like a loaded term, but trajectories of players peaking at the right time. Like, Tim David probably went for 2 or 3 crore more because he made huge runs in the PSL 2 days before the auction. We like to pretend that teams aren't influenced by that kind of thing. I know people on the tables, they are. Like, it does matter. Like, they do see those kind of things. People who are not necessarily across T20 cricket around the world, they see it and they get caught up in the hype and they get this moment of like, oh, we're getting the next big thing. But then as soon as they don't deliver immediately, they have this little dip, particularly if you're a low order batsman, you just move on to the next thing. And the IPL is probably the worst for it because it's the highest standard, and as a result we hold players to a higher standard, to higher accountability, and if you don't immediately succeed. And we've seen it with Liam Livingstone had a terrible Rajasthan career with like the 4 or 5 opportunities that he got. Glenn Phillips was getting picked over him. He's an IPL fraud, get him out of the side, Liam Livingstone. And it's just like, yeah, maybe not, because then he comes back in, he's given a consistent role in a side which is backing him. I'm not convinced by Punjab in lots of ways, but they clearly have an ethos of how they want to play, and it's basically everyone be Liam Livingstone. And shock, he's doing really well and he's succeeding. And it just shows that we get caught up in the, maybe we's a, you know, a kind term, but I think a certain group of fans maybe are too critical of players when they don't succeed straight away. And I think, you know, you don't necessarily want to defend guys that are getting, you know, £1 million to sit on the backsides for a month, but it must be hard when you feel like you're the coming guy and you're the next big thing. And then all of a sudden you're sat playing practice games and doing throwdowns for Rohit.
And also, like what you were saying earlier about Brooke, who's had 2 or 3 amazing white ball tournaments in the last 12 months, but one really, really bad one in the middle in what was arguably the weakest of the leagues that he played in. And also, like that role in particular, batting 4, 5, 6 in T20 is just so difficult.
So high variance.
You're not actually facing that many balls when you have a bad tournament.
And Simon Dool always talks about this on commentary, and I think it's a really apt point, but the pressure of being the overseas as well, it's not nothing.
Especially when you've not done it that many times.
You're a young
before.
English kid who's just torn up the 100, but by torn up the 100 you mean had 3 or 4 really good innings in a really, you know, a high quality tournament, but then you've been asked to go overseas and go to a new country and go to a new environment and succeed for a side who have been pretty solid recently. And you know, these guys have had Jofra Archer as their overseas in the last 2 years, you know, and you're expected to deliver something similar. They've had Tim David as their overseas very recently. And I can understand the pressure. I think we're still in an environment where we're learning how to understand exposure in T20 leagues, and the idea of, you know, if Harry Brooke went and played in the Vijay Hazare or the Syed Mushtaq Ali, you know, we would probably or even just if he went and played in the Ranji, we wouldn't expect him to smash it straight away. If he was like playing as, you know, for the 28th best red ball side in India, he goes in, has an opportunity, maybe has a couple of games. Players have always gone and played in overseas tournaments, whether it be grade cricket in Australia or whatever, but their performances aren't live on telly for hundreds of millions of people to watch. And so we're seeing learning curves happen in real time. And I think as a cricket culture, as a young cricket culture, particularly focused on T20 cricket, we're not used to dealing with the highs and lows of that. And I think that is something that we'll learn in coming years, I think. Or I hope we do, because it's pretty grim at the moment.
It's about the price tag as well, which players just have no control over,
particularly in auctions as well.
Exactly. So you end up buying Tim David, and actually it's funny, when you're making that auction decision, you're doing it because, you know, this is a young guy who has lots of potential. We think he could be a guy to build the side around in a few years time, so he's worth that much money. And also it's because of what other teams want, that will affect how much a player is worth. And then all of a sudden it gets to the tournament time, it's like, right, we have spent, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions on this guy, and we expect a player who is worth that much right now. And that becomes, and actually, you know, and you can almost get and end up getting less time in the side if more money has been spent on you, because you're not a, you know, a 14 crore player. When you, you know, that's not your fault that you're that, you know, you end up not making decisions based on who other players available to us and what's the best team we can pick. It's like, this guy is not delivering on what we expected. So let's, you know, and we're maybe we're planning to get rid of him. And so we're not going to have the side around him now. Yeah.
And also, not to put too fine a point on it, but teams shit themselves because they realize after five games, they're like, we've won one of our five games and we need to win nine to go through. We need to start winning right now. We'll deal with whether or not we retain Tim David at the end of the season or whatever. I mean, a great example is Bairstow. Like, Punjab spent, you know, big money on him, not an obscene amount of money, but big money, and he's not delivered anything. There's a decent argument that they should drop Bairstow because Rajapaksa is smashing it, Livingston's smashing it, bringing in an extra bowler and boost their side, or go with Odin Smith or something. There's arguments around it, but Bairstow is their flagship guy along with Livingston. So you need to back him through. But I do just think sometimes it just shows you, like, best laid plans and all of that, then everyone, you go into these seasons and you think that we want to play cricket this way. He's our gun guy. He's our gun bowler. This is how we're going to do it. And then it takes so little time because people panic. People worry about their jobs. People worry about their futures. And suddenly everything becomes how to get through the next three games, how to get through the next four games. And that's when you end up with really random team selections and people being dropped who don't necessarily deserve to be dropped. And I think sometimes from the outside, you have to recognize that not everything is being made with the cool, analytical, calm, I'm looking to simulate the IPL 150 times. And actually, if you bat Bairstow at three, he's slightly better than at four. And I think sometimes you need to realize it's about winning game of cricket this week, because then it's better for everyone in the long run. I don't know. I love the IPL, but the circus around it is exhausting, and the cricket is just unreal, and I love it more than any cricket in the world, but it takes it out of you, and part of that is because people are so keen to judge so much quickly.
I think on overseas players and expectations around them, I think that is something that I think people are just going to have to get used to over time, that, you know, the IPL is the best franchise league in the world, and you're expecting players who have not, you know, players like Tim David, who, by the way, did well the other day, players like him to come into a level they've never played at before and expect them to be one of the best players in that at that level they've never played at before. Like, that is, when you put it like that, is just unrealistic. So I think that would be something that, you know, I mentioned speaking to Duckett earlier. I remember he said, like, you know what? It's really difficult being an overseas player. And like,
also particularly people, in COVID times as well.
And people don't appreciate the differences between each league, not just from a quality point of view, but in terms of just surfaces, ground dimensions. It's a different challenge in each different league, and for a younger player that is more challenging. Final bit of news today, Nicholas Pooran has been named as West Indies new white ball captain, replacing Kieran Pollard. On many levels, the obvious replacement, but I guess this probably means that he's even less likely to play test cricket in the short or medium term future, which is a shame. And finally, there is a new women's tournament being played in Dubai at the moment called the Fairbreak Invitational, where there are 90 players from 35 different countries, including some of the best players in the world like Shabnim Ismail and Sophie Eccleston. I spoke to Georgie Heath, who's out there at the moment, about the competition, which is unlike any other in the world game at the moment. Georgie, a very simple question first up. What is the Fairbreak Invitational?
So Fairbreak Invitational is basically a massive celebration of the global women's game. So it's a tournament involving six teams with players from over 30 countries around the world. And that's full member status and associate nations. So there's one team we've got here and it's got 13 nations represented. So it's six teams coming together for a T20 tournament across the next 2 weeks. We're in Dubai. And it's just going to be a representation of how good the women's game can be across the world, and giving a chance for those nations who don't necessarily have the coverage they get to prove what it is that they can do and how good the women's game has become and just how far it can go, really.
You're spending a lot of time in and amongst the camps. Have you spoken to any of the players who are from associate nations? How are they feeling about this opportunity to play with some of the best players in the world?
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, sometimes I find myself starstruck by some of the big names, and then you talk to other players and they're like, I'm being bowled at by Shabnim Ismail today, or I today was bowling at, you know, Soph Devine, who's in the nets, or I sat on the boundary rope the other day and Soph Devine just was just talking, you know, and you can tell everyone is just picking up and everyone is absorbing from each other, but it doesn't just work that way. So you've got, you know, your big global star World Cup winners learning from players from, we've got some from Vanuatu, you know, we've got players from Zimbabwe. Maryam Masonda, she's here, she's the captain of the Zimbabwean team, and she hits a fantastic six. And you know, there's just all these players just absorbing so much from each other, already learning so much about their different cultures. And it's really nice to see it. It's sort of got that kind of atmosphere. And I don't know if that's just because the competition hasn't kicked off properly yet, but everyone is just loving life and loving being involved. And they were out in the nets. And when it's nets time, it's concentration time. But aside from that, it's not just, you know, like when you see a World Cup, it's very insular. You're in your team. But it's got this feel about it. And it's, you can tell that everyone is just so excited. It's to celebrate the women's game and what it's become and what it can go to from here. But the action is going to kick off today. And so I think maybe it's down to business from there and it'll be less, you know, less giggles.
What's the atmosphere been like up until this point? Because, you know, there'll be players there who wouldn't have played with, you know, some of the bigger name players before. So what's that been like, seeing the mixing of the very different worlds?
Yeah, it's definitely very much a mix of different worlds. But I think actually, like, everyone is so accepting of that that's how it is, that you sort of come into it with that expectation. But you can tell that some of the players maybe look at these big global stars and they're like, oh, wow. And then they're like, actually, you know what? We're all on a level playing field here. We're all just playing in the same competition. We're on the same team. No name is bigger than the team, you know? So you've got some of these huge global names. You know, you've got your Marizane Capps, your Danny Whites, your number one bowler in the world, Sophie Eccleston. But she's just a spirit team member, and that's how it is. And she's there to do what she does for her team, regardless of what her past might be there. They're all there working for the... They're looking for that trophy, which was unveiled the other day. It's very nice looking. I got nice and close to it and was like, oh, this is quite a snazzy trophy. Definitely not getting my name on this one. But it's looking so good. And like the Associate Nations are, you just can't understand. When you look at them playing, you're like, how is this not getting the coverage? Like, some of the shots these girls can play are insane. And there was one of the Hong Kong players the other day was just facing Tash Farron in the nets, you know, and you might think, Hong Kong player, you know, facing up against someone who's played for England, whatever, but she's absolutely bossing it and owning it. And it's just so nice to see, because you're like, actually, this is going to prove what these other nations have got to offer. And it's fab.
And how did the tournament come about? And do we know already if this is a one-off tournament, or is this going to be something that's going to be held every year?
Well, referring to it as the inaugural one makes me think hopefully more in the future. And I don't know if it would be a every year. I'm thinking probably every 2 years and potentially in Hong Kong for the next one, but don't quote me on that one, but I would think that's the case. And I think they are hoping to, you know, it's going to get that coverage. It's been covered in so many countries across the world. Like, you can even get it over in England on Free Sports on Sky, and there's a lot of streaming going on. So I think it is the hope that it's going to be the first of many and prove that this is the time and the space for this kind of women's tournament.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for your time, Georgie. Can't wait to watch it. That is all we have time for today. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Podcast Network.